half orc, half elf. That wasn't even smart. Let's delete that.
Half orc could be half dwarf, half orc, a dork.
No.
You're right. That's dumb. It's an orf.
I'm not allowing that homebrew, sir. Live from the Mundangerous Space Hulk in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 29 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about getting into character when playing a non-human. But first, the Morning Glory campaign gets a new prophecy, and the Master of Many Forms leaves the game early in the Character Creation Forge.
Before we talk about that, we got a really cool email this week.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
So we've mentioned a couple times on the show a actual play recap written about the 40K RPGs, which have been a frequent topic of conversation on the show recently.
And when we say written, like, it is written the hell out of.
Yeah, like 10,000 words at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Now perhaps friend of the show, Shaggy, the author of the All Guardsmen Party, wrote to us and said, "Hey guys, I saw the Google traffic from your site.
Saw that you mentioned Twitch in the Sentinel episode."
Right, right. Which is just awesome that like that can happen on the internet, right?
Mm-hmm. Note that we also mentioned the All Guardsmen Party in the next episode, episode 24, Character Death.
Yes, because there is lots of character death.
Right. I believe we referenced Darwinian character creation.
Yeah. It's really cool because all of our group read at least part of the All Guardsmen Party, and that's how we originally pitched Dark Heresy to the group,
mm-hmm.
was, hey, here's an awesome story that came out of it. It's hilarious. We should play that game.
Yeah, I told Shaggy this. I actually was not interested in playing a 40K RPG, Dark Heresy 2, or Warhammer Fantasy, anything like that, until I read the All Guardsmen Party, and I said, okay, yeah, this is pretty sweet.
This is going to work.
Yeah, I can get behind this.
But that's not how we're doing character creation.
Right.
We'll just roll one and play from there.
You know, we keep looking for debt packs, and we've never been able to get any debt packs.
We found them in the demolition kit.
No, yeah, they're in the book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm saying in-game, we've never been able to get them.
Yeah.
But it's because we don't have a nubby.
Yep.
Obviously. We need an acquisition spec'd character.
The All Guardsmen Party is why we first learned Scholastic lore of the Tactica Imperialis, so that we could reference the All Guardsmen Party with our characters, with their things like secure the perimeter.
Right. Of course, we never actually follow any of the Tactica Imperialis.
No, we do terrible at implementing yes. it.
We're actually, the only time we reference it is afterward when we say, you know, we really should have done this differently.
Yeah, yeah.
According to the Tactica Imperialis,
right.
This was a stupid idea.
With the exception of any time we enter a place and like spend the night, we always secure the perimeter.
Always. Of course, it's backfired a little bit because now every time anyone in the group in any kind of game enters a room or tries to sneak up on somebody, the first thing you always have to do is check for tripwires.
Right.
Because, of course, there are tripwires. Everyone has tripwires now. Fortunately, it's a really good way to get cheap grenades.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for reaching out, Shaggy. It's awesome to hear from you.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Morning Glory campaign.
Well, last time, Primus, Raoul Kesh, and the entire battle in Metrol all disappeared.
That was our deific being of pure order.
Mm-hmm.
The Rage of War, the
fiendish overlord bursting forth from the depths of Kyber.
And us, we little old adventurers.
So they completely disappeared. The party found themselves in the same place, next to the ruins of the library, in the ruins of Metrol, but all is quiet and calm. The sky is gray. They don't hear really any noise. There are no birds. There are no animals, nothing, except for two creatures flying in the distance. And as they approach, they get larger and larger, and you see feathers. And you think, oh no, more mind-controlled celestials. But it turns out that they are fully in control of their faculties. They land, they greet you. And they wonder, why are you here in the wilderness?
Good question. We are seeking some answers ourselves.
So the party gives their names, sells out Behemoth, and says, by the way, I think there's some sort of devil thing a little bit to the north, but you should go catch that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want him wandering around.
Yeah,
on,
so. Don't trust him.
And don't drink anything he offers you.
And then the angels escort you to a city about 2 miles to the west that they call New Metrol. You get inside, you see that there are people wearing the uniforms of the Siren City Guard, and they promptly arrest you and charge you with the kidnapping of the entire nation of Sir.
It seems like a trumped-up charge.
Nope. So you get thrown in jail, and it's at this point that you realize that Cube, the leftover remnant of Primus, your artifact, is conscious again. Cube, for a very long time, had been unable to communicate or turned off or whatever. When you were in the past, you weren't exactly sure why. However, now, Cube has all its memories back and proceeds with a little exposition. First, Cube apologizes for being so arrogant.
Finally.
Sorry about that time I killed Bastion.
Sorry about that time that you totally warned me this was going to happen.
Yeah, and then I went through with it anyway. Sorry about that time that
I flew off to Whitehall instead of being where I was needed.
Yeah, sorry about all of that. Super sorry. Primus explains that, as you all had surmised, killing Raltul Kesh in the middle of Metrol would have poisoned a huge area of the entire continent, maybe forever. And Primus wasn't about to let that happen, that fiendish taint, corrupt so much of the land. But Primus couldn't teleport away during the battle, since both Raltul Kesh and Primus were sort of dimensionally locking each other, so neither one could escape. So instead, Primus teleported Seer. The process was a little messy, because that's how magic works, right? You don't draw an outline on a map, you just say, Seer, go.
Well, I played a sorcerer, so I have no idea how magic works. It just does.
There's no rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it just happens exactly how I want it to. I have no other way to know how to want it. It happens exactly how I want.
So Primus explains that the process was messy. Not everyone or everything was transported, which explains why there were still dead bodies that weren't decaying, why there are still buildings, entire city blocks sitting in the moorland. And Primus was also only capable of a swap because so much of his power was used up, both containing Raltul Kesh and then fighting Raltul Kesh. So Primus was only able to exchange the entire nation of Seer with the planes that were currently coterminous, which were Maybar and Dolur. We haven't talked a lot about this, but you guys had an apparatus that Cube had developed for you that allowed you to determine at a particular moment what planes were coterminous, remote, waxing, or waning. The planes rotate around the material plane of Eberron, and so at times it's easier to get to them or more difficult to get to them or whatever.
Yeah, up to this point, it had kind of been a curiosity for Lou, and we figured it was probably somehow important, but I think most of us were just like, all right, whatever, there's some astral bodies floating out there, like, fine.
Right, for the most part it was, I don't know, do you want to check to see like what plane is here today?
Yeah, we don't have anything better to do. Check the planes, who knows.
Right, I will say, according to canon, the planes rotate much more slowly than I made them. I think I sped it up by probably a factor of 100 just to keep things moving.
Wow.
I made a calendar. Anyway, while you were in jail and mulling this over and going, huh, okay, that's weird, I wonder what the repercussions of that were, you receive two visitors. One is a young woman who introduces herself as the captain of the guard of New Metrol. She barely looks like she's 16 years old, but that doesn't seem that weird because everyone you've seen here seems to be of kind of indeterminate age.
Almost as if they aren't aging.
She calls herself your advocate and tells you that she's going to help you prepare for your trial.
Yeah, also a misnomer. A trumped up title to match our trumped up charges. She didn't advocate for
her title is advocate.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely not her function.
And after she leaves, you get a second visitor, a Deva, which is a mid-level angel, who introduces himself as Deary and says he will testify on your behalf because he knows that you didn't do it because he was there. And then he reminds you that you had a celestial inside a shard, and that shard was destroyed during the mass disjunction. And so Behemoth was released, as was, you guys had seen, an angel. And he says, well, that was me.
Nice.
And then you guys turned into monsters. And then Primus said, hey, we're going to go stop that fiendish overlord. So I'll tell everyone else that. That's not going to be enough to get you off, but I'll tell them.
That should be enough to get us off. The criminal justice system works very strangely in this world.
I did a lot of research into medieval justice.
Okay, well, you should have just measured us against a duck to see if we were witches.
Or weighed your hearts against feathers, maybe. That'd be equally appropriate. But Deary has one more piece of information for you guys that you didn't have before. He says you turned into monsters and then you flew or ran away, but Behemoth was still there. And they fought for a bit, but neither was able to overpower the other until Behemoth was suddenly enraptured and began speaking in a voice not his own. And you guys have seen this before. It happens when people make prophecies. And Deary, fortunately, being an angel, remembers the prophecy, which is, born of primal murder's pride, dragon spawn, and Dolor's bride, all find disparate goals allied and seek the half-elf suicide. Now to make the cage undone, a key lies with the painted one. Orphan, soul-bound, wayward son, the empty vessel, voice of none. Which is the party's second prophecy.
And we would spend the next 9 months working on that bad boy.
Faster than the first one.
That is true. All right, we'll find out our defense, our criminal defense, next week. So this week's topic, we're talking about playing non-human characters.
It's pretty common.
Yeah. Lots of people enjoy playing elves and halflings and dwarves.
I mean, of the 8 playable races in the PHP, 7 aren't human. I would say the vast majority of the characters that do get played aren't human. But of course, every single one is played by a human.
Yeah, as far as we know.
Yeah.
Every single listener we have is human.
And every single person who's played an RPG, as far as we know.
Also human.
Which means that it can be a little difficult to sort of get into the mindset of something that isn't anything that anyone has ever been.
Yeah, the fantasy races were originally born out of Tolkien's kind of...
Racism.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the dwarves were Scotsmen, right? The Irish were the, what, elves?
Maybe the wood elves.
Of course, the humans were the proud noble Englishmen.
Yes, of course. The men of Western Ess.
Right.
Who lived 250 years.
Mostly humans.
And fell because their blood was tainted with that of lesser men.
Right. Oh, wait, no. The English were halflings. Americans were humans.
Oh, right. Out to the west.
It's
Atlantis.
The Manifest Destiny. Yeah. But anyway, so there's some historical context for why fantasy races are the cliches that they are. The thing is, the culture that's built up around each of these races within D&D now... it's kind of taken on a life of its own. So a lot of times you are playing a type of character who has life experiences and that sort of thing that are completely unrelatable to teenage or middle-aged folks sitting in a basement, sitting around a table, comfortable, playing with their imagination. Mm-hmm. It's very different from, say, an elf who lives for 500 to 700 years, a half-orc who has to fight for his right to exist in human society.
So you can play any of these races just as a collection of mechanical traits and just roleplay them like they're any other human. But that's less fun, it's less immersive, and we think that getting into how this person who doesn't necessarily share the same outlook as a normal human being can really add to the fun of a game.
Yeah, we just did an episode 27, about intraparty conflict. This is a natural source of that conflict. And not just the stereotype of the dwarves and elves don't get along because they don't get along, but the actual difference in worldview of an elf who has centuries to consider and humans who have 60 years to consider. If you're lucky, maybe you can extend that to 150 years or something through magic, but realistically not much longer than that.
Right. If you're an elf who lives that long, how can you not consider the long game?
Right.
You're going to be there.
Exactly. Yeah. It begs the question, why are you adventuring at all? Well, you've got a lot more life to lose, sir.
Exactly. More to lose. Got to save that world because you'll still be here.
But those are the types of things that you should think about, right? These are the types of differences that can bring positive conflict and develop character drama at the table.
So let's dive deep into the different kinds of things that usually sort of get hand-waved when you're dealing with playing a character that isn't human. I think the first one is just physiology.
Yeah, I mean, humans look different from half-orcs, look different from dragonborn, look different from tieflings.
Mm-hmm. And usually on the surface and in interactions during the game, your appearance is what comes up the most. The half-orc is big and maybe hairless and kind of green and has some teeth that stick out.
Yeah, it's always, what color is your skin? Which part of the color wheel does your skin fall on?
Do you have fur on your face?
Are your horns curved or are they straight? Do you have horns at all? How big are your front teeth?
Yeah, that was always one of the big things with 3.5 and earlier tieflings was they were almost human looking and they had something that made them stick out that was weird and you kind of knew that they weren't quite human and they would always try to disguise themselves as human.
Yeah, I think that was one of the big pushbacks of Dragonborn when they were introduced as a core race in 4th edition was just that they didn't look remotely humanoid. They were this reptilian race. They looked purely fantastical, not just kind of base fantasy. Tieflings look like a variant of human, but Dragonborn can't ever be mistaken for anything else.
Right. I think that's probably in 4th edition one of the reasons that they made tieflings look so much more non-human.
Yeah. I'm trying to get rid of that visual stereotype. Right.
So when you're thinking about your appearance for your particular character, it's really sort of the same as when you are playing a human. You know, you might have an ugly human or a fat human or a bald human. It's just when you're playing a particular race that has very specific physical characteristics, all of you look that way. It's not weird. In fact, the human's kind of weird because why do you have all this hair on your face?
Yeah.
And everywhere else. It's really gross.
Brand was bald.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
You're right.
I pointed that out like one time. He was. Well, he was middle-aged. Yeah. But I always imagined him looking like Bruce Willis with like an extra like 60 pounds of muscle.
Did he have a goatee too or no?
No, he had no facial hair. And then, I mean, he developed scales.
Right. He was iridescent scales.
Dragon sorcerer.
So in the same way that you're thinking, what is my charisma score and how does that reflect in my appearance or my personality and the way that people react to me? What is it like when you're adventuring and you have scales or you have fur because you're a cat person or you just have pointy ears?
Or perhaps very long pointy ears. You got to think about from a racial perspective, what makes you unique amongst that race?
Or not unique. You know, what is it that lets you blend in, something that isn't noticed?
Yeah. So when you introduce your character, think of it as, like all Rodians, I have these funny tubes for ears.
Why are you calling them funny tubes? They're just tubes to us.
Or, you know, unlike most half-orcs, I don't have any horns. Those sorts of things that help not only establish what you look like, but also how that compares to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Unlike most Dragonborn, I have grayscales.
These are very useful questions to ask yourself when you're developing backstory. What kind of environment did this character grow up in and how were they responded to simply because of the way that they looked? Remember, they're probably minimum 16 years old at this point. They've lived their entire lives probably looking like this. They're used to it. Even if it's been a bad experience or good experience, they're used to it. It's normal for them.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you mention age, right? Because I think your physical appearance matters more to a younger character. Whereas, for example, Brand, he didn't care one way or another what he looked like. He had high charisma, and that was all force of personality. Mm-hmm. He had a 1,000-yard stare, you know? I mean, he had seen stuff, and he was older than the rest of the party, save the elf. It was just a different perspective for him. He was a half-elf, but had a very human experience because he was kind of magically touched to become a half-elf.
And grew up in the church, which doesn't really care as long as you're not a shifter.
Exactly. Very important that you're not a shifter.
Along with appearance is other physical characteristics like your stature. Dwarves are short. All dwarves are short. You might be a very tall dwarf, but you're short in general for a humanoid. And that affects the way that you see the world, literally affects the way that you see the world, the way you experience it, the places that you're comfortable in. All dwarves probably like crowds less than the average taller humanoid.
Or halflings especially.
Right. They also probably are more comfortable in high winds. They're just shorter and have a lower center of gravity.
And they're also an underground dwelling society. So the open air market, the bazaar in the city's capital that's full of people is going to be a very uncomfortable space compared to, say, the inside of a tavern or deep within the stacks of the royal library.
Right. Now, that could be mitigated because your character also has often a racial build. Dwarves are kind of stocky.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe people in the bazaar are pushing them, but they're probably not going to move. Whereas a halfling, they need to dodge out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
They're nimble for a reason, but they could easily get bowled over if they're caught unawares.
Right.
Whereas a Goliath, they're 7 feet tall, huge muscles. The weakest Goliath has a strength of 12.
Right. When the crowd parts before you, as you move through it, because of your size, you're going to have a different outlook on life when somebody stands up to you. Your natural approach is going to be to move that thing out of your way physically, because you've always moved things out of your way physically.
You've also got training in athletics, so you're good at it.
Right.
No Goliaths are bad at it.
Right. This is the kind of interesting thing, right? Like, what happens when a dwarf and a Goliath cross each other's path? The sort of dwarven pride and maybe a little bit of the Napoleon syndrome put up against literally physical embodiment of power. Mm-hmm. How do they interact at that point? Who's willing to bend?
And keep in mind, you can have a dwarf who isn't stubborn in any way, and you can have a very gentle Goliath. We're talking about the parts of a personality that are built simply because of who you are, what you look like, what you're physically capable of.
Right.
Goliaths have a tendency to be more straightforward in their interactions simply because all of them are very strong and trained in athletics.
Right.
And the racial traits that come along with races and subraces can also really inform the way that your character sees and interacts with the world, especially things like resistances. Dwarves are resistant to poison.
Yeah, they should never be afraid to eat or drink anything.
Right. And if they do actually take poison damage from something they ate, it should be a shock.
Right.
It should actually terrify them, because if it can hurt their stomach, it's super dangerous.
Yeah.
And of course, it explains the dwarven racial proclivity toward heavy drinking.
Right.
Because they're just less affected by it.
Yeah, they just need that much more to get the effect.
Right. It's not because they're drunks, really. That is a human perspective on this.
Yeah, that's definitely what the elves are proposing, you know?
Yeah.
It's like with their fine fortified wines. Mm-hmm.
Especially 3.5 elves with their minus two cons.
Yeah.
This is rice wine, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The other PHB race that has a really good resistance is tieflings. Resistance to fire? That really has to affect your outlook.
Yeah. Cooking becomes a lot safer.
Right. I was just going to say tiefling chefs. That's a great idea.
Tiefling firefighter, you know? You don't even really need water. You just kind of go smother the flames.
Right. I'll just sit on it.
Yeah.
It takes literally twice as much fire to kill you.
Right.
That's a lot of fire.
That's a lot. And then you've got like elves have immunity to charm.
Resistance to charm, immunity to sleep.
Fair enough. But either way, if you never have to worry about somebody swindling you magically, does that change your naivety towards the world? How does that impact you if you just know you don't have to worry about this? It can't affect me.
Right. Does your elven wizard have a habit of dropping sleep right at his own feet because he knows he's immune?
Right.
Who cares? Oh, I caught a few people in the crossfire. Well, it's just sleep.
Yeah, or sleep is a funny one too, because, you know, elves trance instead of sleeping. Mm-hmm. So they probably know things about the party that the party itself doesn't, you know? It's like they know what you're like in your sleep. They've heard all of you tossing and turning with your night terrors.
I draw you at night.
I know you pee.
Some races sleep in certain ways and others don't. Warforged don't sleep at all.
Nope.
They're just awake all the time. There's no new day.
Right.
Existence is just one long day.
I think Warforged have to have a way to clear their mind, right? The mm-hmm. Warforged monk makes a lot of sense to me, because right. they have to have this sort of zen-like patience. Otherwise, they're going to be antsy and like bouncing off the walls.
Yeah, there really needs to be a way for them to mark that time off. Or I bet a Warforged who wants to be more like a flesh and blood race probably does go out of their way to mark that time down. Mm-hmm. But a Warforged who is really embracing their sort of living construct self, maybe they do just say, no, everything is one day. These times, these hours and these days that you place on things because of the movement of random celestial bodies, that's silly.
I'm thinking also Warforged don't eat. So I'm thinking of the Warforged chef who's never tasted his own creations.
But he's amazing.
You know, but he's the Iron Chef.
That's right. Right? Some races also have proclivities to certain kinds of magic. I'm thinking of gnomes, for example, often can speak to small woodland animals.
Or their mastery of illusions.
Or high elves begin with a cantrip of their choice, and tieflings get hellish rebuke. Being able to innately cast magic, one, to know that it exists,
Yeah, I mean, that speaks a lot to the rarity of magic for you. In the hinterlands, humans might not even believe in magic.
Right. Like some far-flung planet where, like, no one there has the gift.
Right. And instead, every single elf knows magic. They just innately do it.
How do you look at an entire race of people who literally none of them can without training when your children do, in fact, have to? Our three-year-olds enchant gophers and send messages. You know? And yeah, it's just a thing that you do. We didn't even have to teach them. It just happens.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, you're ready now.
Right, yeah. It's that stereotypical, we elves don't call it magic.
Right.
And, you know, why would you call it magic?
Yep. That speaks to the pervasiveness of human society across all lands throughout fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the human conventions of naming and philosophy kind of pervade into other cultures. The elves probably don't have a word for magic. Their word for magic is the human word for magic.
Right.
Because the concept doesn't exist to them prior to human interaction.
And so if you're playing a non-human character, your culture has likely adopted in many ways this human way of thinking about the world, or has been resistant to this human way of thinking about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of ways, you'll actually be sort of resistant to the perspective that is presented in the player's handbook, because it is, by its very nature, a human-centric perspective.
Yeah, the player's handbook is written for players.
Right.
And you are playing a character, not a player, mm-hmm. right?
And perhaps one of the things that affects in-game play, but also absolutely your literal perspective, is your movement abilities. Dwarves move more slowly. Arakocra fly.
Yeah, that's crazy, yeah. Right? An entire race of people who are not bound by gravity.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
Right. How does it affect the way that you view simple tasks, like visiting someone one town over?
Or sending a message.
Right.
Likewise, think of the relationship to natural events, right? Mm-hmm. Like the weather. Lightning and thunder would be much more frightening to an Arakocra,
mm-hmm.
whereas lightning and thunder also mean rain, which is how humans sustain themselves through farming.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a low fantasy setting anyway.
Right.
And so as long as there's low enough level of magic, humans have subsistence farming, right? And so that's a blessing for a farmer. It's a curse for an Arakocra.
Because likely Arakocra at lower technological levels are probably more likely to be nomadic,
mm-hmm.
because they can fly. Right. Why not move?
Why not move? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why not chase the eternal summer?
That's right. I'm wondering if a race that can fly has nearly the same fascination with birds or even the stars that humans would. Because part of the reason that we look up and we're fascinated with things up there is that we can't get off this place.
Right, right.
It's so hard to move to other places. But if you can just fly straight up for half a mile and it's not a problem.
Well, I mean, until you get caught on fire by the sun, Icarus.
Oh, right. Well, my wings aren't made of wax. I'm an Arakocra.
They're made of very flammable feathers.
Well, my father was a tiefling, so I have 1/4 resistance to fire. I think I'm cool.
That's homebrew. That's not allowed.
I'm Arakocra dragon sorcerer.
I'll allow it.
There we go.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The human inclination towards the stars and alternatively the sea. The two places we can't go naturally are such an obsession for humans, right? That's mm-hmm. Sort of our natural curiosity and our internal manifest destiny. We want to conquer those places where we can't go.
Mm-hmm.
How do other races feel about that? The elves are so at home in forests, or wood elves, for example. Why would they ever want to leave? It's a very different kind of attitude.
Or they have their entire lives. If they wanted to walk around the entire world, they could. They just take 50 years to do it. No big
mm-hmm.
deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arakocra, or any flying race, maybe they don't feel that same kind of wanderlust, because you can always go over the next hill or over that mountain.
Yeah.
And it's not a big deal.
You can see the ends of the earth. Like, literally, you can just see them.
Right. You can go there, and then you can come back.
Because, reminder, planes are flat.
Obviously. Except Bytopia, which is 2 flat planes.
Right.
So all of that is just questions based on the physical capabilities of your character's form.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't even started talking about things like culture.
Part of it is that culture can be very setting specific.
Mm-hmm.
And even within races, there are often different cultures. I know we're talking about non-humans, but just look at the variety of human cultures on Earth, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the different sets of elves and the different dwarves and the different halflings, to say nothing of the more rare races, right? How do half-elves get treated in a certain society, or how do tieflings with their infernal nature, how do these strange 600-pound dragon people get treated?
Mm-hmm. They don't ride horses.
Definitely not.
Well, they ride dead horses.
Well, they've they're not warm-blooded, so they hate winter.
They get very sleepy.
No, dragonborn are warm-blooded.
Yeah, they are, actually.
Otherwise, it would be a very inconvenient game.
They would have vulnerability to cold,
yeah.
Which they don't. They have to be warm-blooded.
So without getting into the specifics of a setting, why don't we talk about some of the things to consider culturally? Let's say it's a homebrew world, or you're just the sort of aspects you want to think about when you're playing non-humans.
Different settings usually place their races in different niches.
Mm-hmm.
So once you figure out what setting you're in, then it's usually pretty simple to figure out where your particular race fits in. So if you're in Dark Sun and you're an elf, you're probably a nomadic trader. So you know a bit about sand sailing. So what is it that you spent your youth doing? That's probably one of the first questions. And then that comes up really with the selection of the background.
Yeah, so think of what is the typical youth of an elf in Dark Sun like? What is a typical childhood like? And then figure out, does yours match that, or how is it different? But start with the expectation and then kind of play with it from there.
Right. You don't need to play the stereotypical, whatever it is, elf or dwarf or halfling. But it's really helpful to know what the stereotypical version is, so you know how you react to it, whether you fit in perfectly and you're sort of the archetypal version of that, or if you're totally the opposite or somewhere in between.
Yeah, that's why I like to define my character as like all elves, unlike most elves,
mm-hmm.
unique amongst elves, unique amongst Dragonborn. I am the last Dragonborn.
Unique amongst drow. I am kind. I live on the surface. And I am a range. Oh, wait, no. There's another.
There can be only one. That's how Drizzt got all his power. He just kept defeating all of his mm-hmm. imposters.
And a bunch of Jet Lis.
What about government? What's the ruling structure? How is power distributed amongst a racial culture?
It's important to know. And I think it's really important for an adventurer to know, because a lot of the time, the reason that you move away from your society and become a wandering adventurer is there wasn't really another avenue for you to advance.
Yeah, you didn't have a place.
Among long-lived elves, do people just stay in power perpetually, either elected or in hereditary rule for 500 years? It's really difficult to wait for an opening on the council.
Those seats are going to be rare to come by.
That's
yeah,
right.
For sure.
They're probably getting sold.
There's probably an assassination or two in order.
So there's often just not a lot of opportunity to move up. However, if you're an orc or a half-orc and the life expectancy among warriors is 22,
right,
you probably have moved up the ranks very quickly.
Yeah. All you got to do is knock somebody over the head.
Yeah. And maybe even though you're now an adventurer, that's the way that you grew up. That is the way that you're used to dealing with advancement. Maybe that's how you respond to intra-party conflict.
Right.
Also, what does the average member of your race do for leisure during their downtime?
This is also going to be one of those super tech / magic dependent kind of questions, because in a low magic feudal fantasy campaign, the answer for most races is probably nothing. People worked, or they died. They starved.
But when you're an elf who can cast cantrips or sing to trees,
right,
leisure time is really a different kind of concept. Really, it's, I don't know, I took a decade off.
Yeah. Yeah, I took a nap. It was great.
Or think about a dwarf. Again, the stereotypical dwarf loves rocks and minerals and stonecraft and architecture. Now, maybe your character does, maybe your character doesn't, but your character, if they grew up in a stereotypical dwarf society, has been around people who are interested in those things and absolutely has picked things up by osmosis, which is why on your sheet you've got stone cunning.
Mm-hmm.
You may not care at all about architecture, but you know about it.
Right.
And maybe that's annoying to you and you feel like it was a waste, but that certainly informs your reactions to those kinds of interactions.
Keep in mind that the normal activities of a culture informs what your escape is in the mm-hmm. form of leisure. So, for example, drow are incredibly cruel. They're very competitive. They're greedy. They're backstabbing. What does a drow want most for his leisure time? I would imagine it would be escape. So I bet there are a lot of drug-using drow.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for something to just mellow out. Lots of mushrooms underground, as it turns out. I mentioned drow because we're kind of talking about D&D and fantasy races, but that's literally what happens to Dark Eldar in Warhammer 40K. Is mm-hmm. they have to be torturous and cruel in order to sustain themselves. That's just part of how they exist. But they're also obsessed with drugs. Like, it's drug, sex, and rock and roll for them, right? Their existence is in the shadow of their souls condemned to an evil god. So any release they can get is worth it.
And the opposite of leisure, wartime activities. Traditional D&D settings have a history of hostilities between certain races. Dwarves don't like elves. Dwarves hate kobolds and goblins. Dwarves hate giants. Okay, mainly the dwarves fight with everybody.
Well, I mean, humans actually fight with everybody.
Also right? True.
But yeah, nobody likes the orcs. Nobody likes the goblins. Mm-hmm. Kobolds get usually like a 50-50. You know, right. Dwarves generally hate them, but they're not generally dangerous enough for anybody to really exterminate them.
So if you're a goblin PC, everyone probably hates you. From your youth up through growing up, your entire backstory, people in general have not trusted you, have thought you were sneaky, didn't like you one reason or another. Dwarves probably have tried to kill you.
But when you end up in a party with a dwarf and some humans and elves, and they aren't trying to kill you, they've proven that they trust you, they have invested that in you, and they protect you, how loyal do you become then, right? Yeah. I mean, how desperate are you for that inclusion?
Legolas and Gimli became the best of friends, probably because their races didn't get along initially.
Right.
So all of these things, the way that you interact with your environment because heat doesn't hurt you, or the way that you grew up because of the society of your race, affects your individual outlook, the way that you view life and your regular adventuring day. It absolutely affects the way that you react to danger or death. You have probably a cultural god.
What if you're a warforged and you don't have a soul? How do you view death?
You totally have a soul. You just don't have a god.
Perhaps.
Which is why you go into Moorland and build one.
It also affects your outlook on love. If you're going to live for 700 years and you're going to get married at 100, that is a long time to be with one person, right? Mm-hmm. How tight are your family units then?
Maybe they're very tight, maybe not at all.
We got hundreds of years to live, baby.
Right, I don't know where to settle down.
Right. Or Dark Eldar, we're sterile. We got nothing to lose.
It also affects your ideals. What is important to you? How is your alignment expressed? What do you think a good life looks like? And that's a question that adventurers ask themselves a lot because they need to decide, okay, do we leave these people alone? Do we rescue these people? What is necessary from us in this potentially moral quandary?
Yeah, and how far does that moral responsibility carry us?
Mm-hmm.
How far is far enough? How long until we've completed and assuaged our conscience?
Mm-hmm. It also, in the long term, in-game, can affect your goals. Because no matter how tight the party is, there's almost always some sort of existential thought about the fate of your entire race. So, for example, in the Morning Glory campaign, Bastion was committed to the party, but he was also very committed to the perpetuation of the Warforged race and the freeing of them.
That definitely became a point of pandering.
Yeah, came up later.
So we should talk for a bit about how to actually express these things at the table, because it's great to think about this as you're developing a character, but ultimately you're sitting at a table with 5 or 6 other people, right? The time that you have to kind of spotlight this is limited. So how do you show rather than tell about these sorts of thoughts and these sorts of decisions that you've made about your character?
They don't necessarily need to come up out at the table. but it's good to have this information that informs your character's outlook, and then it gets combined into their general backstory and then also their personality. So if you think of a real person, when I respond to things I'm not thinking about all the time or necessarily even talking about, all the things that happened to me as a child, you know, all the different things that I grew up with and that I know in great detail but that I don't subscribe to anymore, but they all come together to form a particular personality.
Yeah, and then I think as a GM, you can also point to those things more directly with your moral challenges, right? When you impose those kind of quandaries, you can make them very targeted. And so as we're discussing what we'll do as a party, right, I have the chance to say, well, I'm an elf. This is how elves view this. You have to understand, I don't care about the next 50 years. We have to solve this problem much longer term. You guys are thinking too small.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, the dwarf is saying, well, I only care about my clan. This doesn't benefit the glory of my clan at all. I'm not going along with this. And then the half-orc just, you know, smashes something. I don't know. What do half-orcs do?
That's racist.
It's totally racist.
Apologize to all the half-orcs.
Yes, all of our half-orc listeners have tuned out. Now we can really talk about them behind their backs. What I want to caution you against, though, as players, don't derail a group story, a campaign, in order to just to highlight one of these sorts of background aspects. The consideration is valuable, but building a character who's such a unique snowflake doesn't work, right? You have to be party friendly in the way that you think about these things as well.
Right. The exercise of going through all these questions about what makes your particular race unique or where it fits in the world is not to separate yourself from the rest of the party. It's to place it in the world. It's to help you determine goals and outlook, but still, ultimately, you're a party. And like we talked about in the intra-party conflict episode, part of the reward of the party coming together and acting as a cohesive unit is having overcome a lot of these obstacles. So yeah, maybe you have a racial hatred for halflings for whatever reason.
Because they're creepy and short.
They have giant heads, it's true.
And their feet are so messed up.
Really hairy.
Not in the PHB. They can't have hairy feet because that's all copyrighted. But in the PHB, all the halfling feet are drawn so weird. They're like misshapen. It's weird. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
That's somebody's fetish.
It's certainly not mine.
So for whatever reason, maybe your character hates halflings, but there's a halfling in the party. Part of the reward of adventuring together for so long is learning about your prejudices and then realizing that they're not applicable, or you can make an exception in this one case, or whatever.
Vocalize that early on as just kind of pithy remarks about the halfling, right? Mm-hmm. Call him short stuff. And maybe when he misses in combat, you make a quip about it or something, right? You don't need it to be the most personal thing in the world. And then over time, as you develop your character, right, those go away and they get replaced with friendly camaraderie or whatever, right? You treat him like you treat anybody else, that sort of thing.
Right. The more interesting aspects of your race will come from the larger ideals and goals. If you're an elf from Arinel, you have a different outlook on death. And that really informs the way that you deal with prisoners, or the way that you deal with saving a village, or your comrades who fall in battle.
Right, because the elves of Arinel are all necromancers.
Right. And their god is a conglomeration of their risen dead. But they're good.
They're all right. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
I think that's the rattling bones of my ancestor gods.
It is actually the sound of the Character Creation Forge. Before we move on to the forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us, if you can't fit it into 140 characters, at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And last but not least, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So we promised you the master of many faces in the Character Creation Forge this week.
Which is to say, he is the character who can adopt whatever form, whatever face is required at the time. So, Ishan, What's the build?
It's Rogue One, Warlock 17.
Ishin?
Yeah.
That's only 18 levels.
Yep, that's all you need.
We usually build 20 levels.
Yep, but you're not gonna.
Oh, right, because you can't get past level 18 with this build, right?
That's correct. We said it leaves early.
It was definitely Brand's endgame, I'll just say that. Okay, so I don't blame you at home if you haven't figured out how this becomes the master of shapeshifting. Let's explain.
We're building toward a capstone, like we usually do in these builds.
Yes, we are building towards true polymorph.
Not shape change?
Nope, true polymorph.
Not wish?
Not wish, true polymorph. Because true polymorph allows you to turn into an adult gold dragon.
Mm-hmm. CR17, which you can do as early as level 17.
Right. When you true polymorph after the end of the concentration,
1 hour,
it becomes permanent. You are now no longer yourself. You are a gold dragon, complete with all of its game statistics, all of its mental capabilities, all of its innate spellcasting, and this handy at-will shape-shifting ability.
Change shape, which, compared to anything else in the game, is...
It's the most powerful ability in the game, period. I'm willing to say it.
From an RP perspective, totally. Change shape lets you turn into any humanoid or beast with very few restrictions on the things that you're able to do. So you maintain your hit points, your hit dice, your legendary resistance, really all the things that make being a gold dragon really good, but you can just turn back into, I don't know, your old self.
Right.
You don't have all of your class features anymore, but you're still a gold dragon and you can turn back into a gold dragon anytime that you want.
At will. Okay, so we've established our goal here. Get to level 18, become a gold dragon, shapeshift into whatever you want to at will. Why are we warlock again? How do we get this Rogue One Warlock 17? What's the benefit here?
Because who else but a warlock, an insane warlock, would want to just turn into things all the time?
That's kind of a good point, yeah. That is definitely a great old one, warlock.
It's also because warlocks are charisma-based, so you'll be very good at deception. So while you're building to true polymorph, you'll be able to turn into different creatures and then convince people that you actually are that creature or that person.
Mm-hmm.
Because warlocks get multiple invocations that let them change at will. You get Mask of Many Faces, which is disguise self at will. At level 15, you can get Alter Self at will. There's another invocation that lets you cast Polymorph once a day. Plus plenty of other spells that let you change shape.
Okay, but what about Druid? Druid has wild shape.
Yeah, we considered that. But Druids can only turn into beasts, and beasts top out at CR 8.
Yeah, and this is the master of many faces, not just beast faces.
Yeah, not the master of many muzzles.
Right.
So the nice thing about Alter Self at will is that it has the change appearance option. You can just look like anyone you want. And with your great deception, because you also have expertise, Rogue One, everyone's going to believe you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, once you're a gold dragon, everyone's going to believe you because they have to.
Right. You have, like, what, 26 charisma?
Right. Now, there doesn't seem to be a mechanism in the game for once you are actually a gold dragon to continue to gain XP and level up.
Which is why this build ends at 18.
However, if you do this, I would make the argument to your GM that, you know, 500 years later, you should grow up into an ancient gold dragon.
Right. Time is on your side.
That's right. You can build a lair. Also, remember, you get the legendary actions. That's insane for a PC.
Yeah, after every single turn.
Yeah, 3 times per round.
Ugh.
So good. Yeah. Tail slap.
Exactly.
Tail slap.
I disagree, sir. Tail slap.
Of course, now you have the outlook of a gold dragon. So you're not human anymore. Maybe you just fly away and eat some treasure.
That's the thing, yeah. Right? I think you now have all of the power of a gold dragon. Like, silly humans, this is stupid. I don't care about your plight. Mm-hmm. I leave.
Yeah. Turns out your husband, he smells really delicious now.
Yeah. Though I will say, gold dragons are also, they have that sort of whimsical curiosity where, you know, when you got 500 years to kill until you become an ancient gold dragon, why not pretend to be a human for a while?
It's true.
So it wouldn't surprise me to see a gold dragon shape change back into his human form, right?
There's a reason we have half dragons.
Yeah.
Also, after ancient, then you should go Dracolich. Why not?
Well, is Draco Lich more powerful than just a plain old Lich?
No. Oh, I guess you could turn back into a human and then turn into a regular Lich.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a better idea.
Just go ahead and Lichify. So obviously this build is not a serious one.
If one of you had done this in Morning Glory, I would have let you play the dragon.
This would have been right up Lou's alley. She was a great old one warlock. She was obsessed with aberrations. And so if there had been an aberrant high-level form, I'm certain that she would have tried something like this.
Yeah, Monster Manual 2, because I think Beholder tops out at 13.
Yeah, well, yeah. Or Death Tyrant goes to 15,
but that's undead. Yeah. Yeah.
And then as soon as we started putting this together and started whimsically thinking of the possibilities for a gold dragon, I realized that Bran, being the gold dragon sorcerer, definitely did this as his end game. Like, mm-hmm. After the end of the campaign, he went, got himself a scroll, turned himself into a gold dragon permanently, and then shapeshifted back into himself.
Went back to work.
And continued what he was working on. Yes, exactly. Saving the world from whatever the next threat is. So we've talked about two characters in the Morning Glory campaign. What is your character? Why does your character want to become the master of many faces?
Terrible childhood. Terrible childhood, doesn't like their own face, doesn't want to be them.
Wow, that's dark.
I mean, they're a warlock. Level one warlock.
Yeah, is it too cliche to just claim the great old one warlock has just made you crazy? You know, where maybe you just like freaking people out, you just adopt their own face?
Yeah, that's doable. Right? I also like the trickster archfey warlock.
Okay.
Or the fiendish warlock sells their soul to get out of their horrible circumstances, really hates their face, smashes mirrors, all that kind of thing. And as soon as they can take on anyone else's appearance, they do. They never spend any time in their actual original form. But the plan is become a dragon, grow up into an ancient dragon, and then kill your patron.
I was going to say, that's, you're about to go for like a noble bright turn, but I'll take that the grimdark direction. You're trying to become your patron, right? Like, you are just as mischievous and just as focused on swindling, right? So you are just using this for evil the whole way. You don't have to be a good aligned gold dragon in lots of settings.
You keep your alignment for true polymorph.
You are the only evil gold dragon. And you're an adult, so you're going to be swindling a lot of gold dragons into some evil, right? Mm-hmm. You're the reason that dragons don't work together.
Best thing about being able to fight your devilish patron, immune to fire.
Also, all your abilities are fire.
You should get a demonic patron.
That is enough whimsy for one episode. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Use that to tell us how dumb this idea was. If you're willing to do that, we'll happily read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about munchkins.
Sounds delicious.
Speaking of broken builds.
And in the character creation forge?
We're rebuilding the iconic Mystic Theurge.
That's the half cleric, half wizard.
Mm-hmm. If we can.
Well, that's it for episode 29 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.